Oh boy, Dre. Well, I feel bad that we missed our review of the St. Petersburg episode the weekend of, but now with this month long break until the next round, we can catch right up and it'll be like we didn't miss anything.
Mate, we just had Phoenix this past weekend.
What?
Welcome back to Motorsport 101. Yes, we had a back-to-back to start the IndyCar season, and we're in the middle of a triple header. Isn't that fun? Welcome.
We front-loaded the calendar.
Yeah. Welcome to IndyCar 2026 and episode 642 of Motorsport 101. And according to a certain stat keeper, Mr. Jason the Shuckle, this is my 600th episode of Motorsport 101. 600 appearances for yours truly. Dear God, that's a lot of episodes.
And it could have been more if you didn't have such a crummy day job back in the day.
I missed a lot of episodes through bookmakers, Paddy Power recordings, going from shop to shop and juggling that while being a gambling shop manager at the same time. The 10 episode dissertation has gone very, very wrong at this point that I've turned 10 episodes into 600 for me on there. But a continued thank you for all the support, for inviting us into your homes, your runs, your cars, however you choose to listen and support us. Well, we are very, very grateful.
It's been 10 years since you first brought me on the show almost, and I'm just like,
Jesus Christ.
Passage of time is bullshit. Well, Dre, look, Formula One is in utter shambles, right? But look, Formula One, it's non-exclusive problem because MotoGP bikes are the work of the devil. They're lawless creatures, and they should be abolished sooner rather than in 2027. NASCAR fans have never liked the current package for about 20 years, and IndyCar's hybrid package has done nothing but be a net zero or even a net negative. And plus, we're going to Phoenix soon. It's not like that's actually a banger, except it kind of was.
Huh. Well, yeah, that was a very enjoyable Phoenix oval race. And I've got to be honest, I was one of the more cynical ones going into Phoenix thinking, this is probably going to be quite dull because it was quite dull the last time we raced there 8 years ago back in 2018 in our last Phoenix appearance. But it worked out in this occasion. We got a very, very good Phoenix race that was, you know, a welcome return to the calendar, which I was pleasantly surprised by.
And race fans, they yearn for the short ovals. Now, look, St. Pete was exactly what we expected. And we're going to talk about all of it, everything that we learned over these first two races here on this podcast episode.
Yep, that's just me and RJ O'Connell for the next hour or so, breaking down the last two weekends, just seeing the lay of the land in the field and catching you up on all the IndyCar news as we've missed the first round in St. Pete. Apologies for that. It was a bit of a tight cluster with the Formula One season starting up and MotoGP kicking off their season earlier than billed by starting the first week of March. You fiends! But yes, we'll break it all down over the next hour or so, including Pelot dominating St. Pete and a rare moment of Pelot mortality in Phoenix. We'll talk about that very shortly. Is Joseph Newgarden actually back? And is the Willpower Revenge Tour in the room with us right now? All important questions to ask. And wait, what the hell is Mick Schumacher doing fourth on an oval? All that and much, much more very, very shortly. But in the meantime, here's places you can find us real quick. If you want to get video highlights of the show and listen to and see our pretty faces, you can do so at youtube.com/motorsport101, on Instagram, motorsport101 pod, and on TikTok at m101_podcast. If you want to follow us on social media in general, you can do so at facebook.com/motorsport101, Twitter @motorsport_101, and our personal blue sky handles, Dre Harrison. bsky.social and rjoconnell@bsky.social. We're still in shock. The Bam Adebayo scored 83 points in an NBA game last night. What a time to be alive. I mean, we've not even talked about the USA baseball team. If you really like us as well, you can back us financially on Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our episodes. You can upgrade to the $10 tier to listen to these episodes live as they're being recorded, as Kieran, Jason, Vic and Ed are doing right now. Thank you so much for watching along. And of course, you can get all of those details and more on our website, motorsport101.com. Check out the blog section for my full written thoughts on everything we saw past weekend, including F1 in Australia and IndyCar in St. Pete and Florida. Florida and Phoenix, I should say, as you know.
Florida, Arizona, I mean, really, what's the difference in the eyes of some people? One's just the wet heat, the other's just the dry heat, and for some people, they got a lot more Republicans in charge, and they feel comfortable visiting.
More on that very shortly. But let's start the catch-up wagon. Here's IndyCar's 2026 and the story so far.
Last time on IndyCar Z, Goku tried it. I can't do this all day. Look, okay, so the season began, as it usually does, on the streets of St. Petersburg, Florida, with IndyCar playing support to the NASCAR Craftsman Truck Series and the Wheeling Emmett's 5 Cup. I'm kidding, of course. Scott McLaughlin took the pole position and led the field to the first green flag of the year, which was a very short-lived one because it was as short-lived as Mick Schumacher's very first race in the IndyCar Series. It lasted 4 corners. Did you pray today? Mick Schumacher didn't. McLaughlin gave fans hope of an immediate return to form after a winless season last year, but there was just one problem with that. Alex Palou, 4-time defending series champion, is still that guy. Palou overcut McLaughlin and fellow front row starter Marcus Ericsson in the first stint of the race, broke the field over his knee in the second stint, where have we heard this before, and cruised to his 20th career IndyCar win in his 99th start. Or as we like to call it, just another race day in the world of Alex Palou, for which all things IndyCar run through. McLaughlin would at least consolidate second place ahead of Christian Lundgaard after both men drove past Kyle Kirkwood late in the race. Kirkwood fell fourth. Ericsson was a bit unlucky to finish sixth behind Pato O'Ward in fifth.
We had to wait 6 long days for round 2. IndyCar's triumphant return to Phoenix Raceway is part of a NASCAR IndyCar double feature. David Malukas made good on his potential and grabbed the pole, but the story early on was Palou's 100th race start being spoiled via a collision with Rinus VK, taking Palou out of the running and out of the IndyCar points league for the first time in 622 days. The last time Alex Palou wasn't leading the IndyCar series, it was off the Barber in 2024, a race where Palou could only somehow manage fifth. Dreadful day for him. The championship was led by Colton Herta after that round back then. Palou was a stunning 3 points off the lead. Yeah, as you do. Anyway, Mr. Excitement, Christian Rasmussen, went on a tear through the field and eventually passed Pato O'Ward for the net lead. Rasmussen was running second with 44 laps to go when he tried to go around the outside of Will Power for the lead of the race. Got caught up in an incident, cars clashed, and he bounced off the outside wall. The damage to Rasmussen's suspension, he broke both wishbones in the wall impacts, caused him to fade badly after the final caution, and it cleared the way for Joseph Newgarden, who went from 23rd to 7th in St. Pete, to go from 10th to 1st on the final restart and take his first win of 2026, followed home by Kyle Kirkwood and the aforementioned David Malukas. Newgarden now leads the championship, headed into this weekend's inaugural Grand Prix of Arlington. Palou is now 5th in the standings. Oh my God.
Yeah, so 2 very different races, 2 different winners, of course. Dre, I want to ask you, who or what has impressed you most across the first 2 races of the season?
I'm going to be honest. A lot of the usual pretenders that we give a pat on the back to have been, I think, quite good so far this season. Palou was exceptional in St. Petersburg. That was one of his most dominant and most brilliant victories. Which is a weird thing to say about a guy who's got 20 IndyCar wins already.
Reset the largest margin of victory in the 20-plus year history of the Grand Prix of St. Petersburg. I know that's not a long time, but that is a long time in terms of upstart street races in the NTT IndyCar Series. Remember, that race was first run in 2003 as part of the Champ Car World Series. It then jumped across to the other side of the split.
Polo won that race by 13 seconds, and it was, like I said, all in that crushing middle stint where I made a comparison when I wrote about this on the blog, and it's a weird one, so bear with me a bit. If anyone's ever seen the movie Deep Blue Sea, the LL Cool J shark movie, yes, where they create super intelligent sharks. Polo was the shark, and what he was doing is he was basically pushing everybody around the track and forcing them into killing their tires. It was masterful driving. He was in open air completely untouchable. And as Marcus Ericsson and Carl Kirkwood in the back half of that race would try to stay with him in terms of pace and tire delta, eventually they were overcooking their tires trying to stay with him. And that's what led to Polo stretching and stretching his lead into unfathomable territory, in the same way that the sharks pushed the crew around to sink the whole facility and trying to break out into common land. I know, it's a weird comparison, but if you've seen the movie, you'll know what I mean. So for me,
it's something that feels like it's more in our wheelhouse, Dre. John Heisman, coach of Georgia Tech's college football team against Cumberland University, 222-0. If you know, you know. I was just posting John Heisman's stoic face all up in the chat as that second, the final two-thirds of the race were breaking out.
Yeah.
Alex Palou will show this field no mercy, dog.
Better to have died a small boy than fumble this football. That was Alex Palou in St. Petersburg. And look, I'll say this about the second half of this discussion in Phoenix, and we'll talk about it a little bit more in totality. I was always unsure if Christian Rasmussen's win at Milwaukee was a bit of a fluke last year, and that, yes, he had a fantastic season across all the ovals. He was top 10 in all of them except the last one in Nashville. I wasn't sure if that was sustainable or not. I was wrong. This kid is demonic on ovals. Good God almighty. We were watching this race. Like, my brother was in the Discord call. He doesn't normally watch IndyCar races anymore.
I was out socializing with a friend, so I missed a lot of this as it happened. I missed all of it as it happened. I turned on the radio as we're getting in the car, and I hear Joseph Newgarden pulls in a victory lane at the Good Ranchers 250. What?
Right. And, like, how we got there was wild, but the story of the middle of that race was Christian Rasmussen completely tearing through the upper midfield of that race. It wasn't a race like Gateway last year. He got a little bit of the pit strategy going in his favor. It wasn't the 500 where he struggled a little bit and had a bunch of near misses. Somehow didn't fully wreck a race car, but had a lot of spins instead. It wasn't even like Milwaukee, where an act of God came in late on and he had that huge tire offset. This was an aggressive strategy from Rasmussen to run a four-stopper, as opposed to what was we thought was going to be a three-stop race, and then switching to the three-stopper halfway through, given he had the track position to do it. And I think he wins this race comfortably if, and this is going to sound harsh, because he's not to blame for the accident that ultimately ended his race down the order. Mario Andretti made this point on Twitter. So Marco made the point on Twitter.
Grandson.
Yeah. If he was a little bit more patient, he probably gets away with it, and he probably passes power some point else, and he wins the race comfortably. I wonder if he was just a little bit too aggressive for his own good, and ultimately derailed himself out of the win when he had the race car to win comfortably.
That's been the emerging trend is that Christian Rasmussen, I call him Mr. Excitement because he's one of the most exciting drivers to watch when he is on song. He is also a very ruthless competitor, right? There was that anonymous drivers poll where everybody said that of all the drivers on the IndyCar grid, there's one driver you trust the least in close quarters combat. It's Christian Rasmussen. But I also get the feeling that, like, okay, so he's really aggressive. When he's on song, he's unbeatable. He is deceptively good at ovals, and he's not really that apologetic about it. Is Christian Rasmussen really what people try and tell us Santino Ferrucci is?
He might be. Like, he's not the American prospect, which I think is a big part of the reason Santino gets the glaze that he gets, is because allegedly the series needs a homegrown talent when Joseph Newgarden's existed for the last decade. But what do I know? But obviously, IndyCar's weird about this, because if you were watching the broadcast initially, they tried to nickname Rasmussen, and IndyCar's nicknames in the commentary box are very cringy, and they tried to call him now the Sultan of Sketch.
Dog.
Like, Will Buxton tried a razzle dazzle. and I'm just like, you are the average age of this commentary box is like 45. I don't know, but like, IndyCar loves attaching itself to what they think might be the next big thing.
Yeah.
And Rasmussen, look, I still think he needs to really up his road and street course game, because that's a problem. But, correction from Ed. Razzle Dazzle was from Tom Gamewell, as if that's any better.
Yeah, if you're watching this in the United States on terrestrial television, it's just like, that's not even really a factor. But, like, yeah, Rasmussen, if he could just turn it down from about a 12 to a 9, we'll get more wins.
There's no doubt about it, because, like I said, on points last year, he was third overall on ovals. The only two drivers who were better than him on ovals last season was Tanner Award, who we've known for half a decade has been one of the best oval racers in the world, and Alex Palou, who had an incredible year, period, let alone on ovals, because that was a big breakthrough year for it. On pound-for-pound ability, I think it's still Pato and Joseph as the two best oval drivers in the series. They tend to finish 1 and 2 on these ovals a lot over the last few years. It's going to be a more fun time for everybody if Rasmussen's in that level of conversation, and I think he could be. Like, it's now been 5 out of the last 6 oval races he's been in the top 10 or better. He has a win on an oval. He could have won this race easily. He had another podium at Gateway last year. You could be right, RJ. He could be the Ferrucci-esque exciting oval racer that we've all kind of, well, I'll say all of us, but certainly what people within IndyCar want Ferrucci to be, because
yeah,
he's been nowhere to start this season by comparison.
Yeah. Dre, I know you have been very happy on the NASCAR side to see the machine of manufactured hype around Carson Hocevar.
Oh, but fun.
Again, like Ferrucci, they haven't won anything with all that hype and excitement. Rasmussen has.
Right.
And he's got Rolex. He's got a Rolex on one of his wrists, or at least like sitting at home somewhere.
What have we said from day one with Rasmussen?
Was he on a limited road and street course schedule if this was in his locker the whole time?
Correct. Especially because I know it's a limited sample size, but he, for the last 2 or 3 years at Daytona, has been the number one dude in an NMP2. Now, that's not the biggest hurdle to clear in the world, it's NMP2, but there's enough proof that the guy has got talent to be able to race on a road street track against world-class competition at a very prolific, one of the biggest 24-hour races in the world.
Yeah.
That's good. It's great. Yeah. You know, it's proof that he can do it. So, you know, I don't know how much of that was the selfishness, as Kira points out in our chat, that, you know, Ed Carpenter refusing to give up his own status of being the part-time oval guy until last year, really. That was the first year he really stepped back and was like, okay, I'm just going to do the 500 now going forward. Because before that, he was still doing every oval race for no good reason whatsoever. You know, it's not like he was in the top 10 every week when he was on an oval. Yeah. He was in the midfield struggling because Ed's near a 50 now. And there's no shame in that. It's just, you're holding your own team back. You're not being as efficient as you can be as a team boss. Let Christian off the cork. And there's no doubt about it. He's their guy now. And they've got Alex Rossi in the other seat. But all the hype and all the excitement in that camp is coming from the 21 and not the 20, which is a bit of a surprise to me.
You know, I'm thinking they could have kept Rinus VK and Christian Rasmussen. And I understand why they made this move is because they feel like the thing with Rinus had reached its ultimate ceiling. And I would agree with that on the basis of Rinus VK had done all he could at Ed Carpenter Racing. But like, man, if they still had Rinus VK and Ed Carpenter in this setup, sorry, if they still had Rinus VK and Christian Rasmussen in this setup,
it's a hot team. It's a team where you're thinking there's no reason why they can't get at least one, if not both, cars in the top 10 in the points. Mm-hmm. And last year they were 13th and 15th respectively. Like, for all the hype about ECR, the new ownership status, the amount of money they poured into the team, they were pretty much where they've always been. Smack dab in the middle of the field.
It feels different this time. And that's no shade against Alex Rossi. He got sixth at Phoenix, which is more of what you expect than what he showed us at St. Pete, where it looked like the same Alexander Rossi you expect every year since 2020, because I don't understand how just adding a protective windscreen in the car suddenly sucks all of one's talent out, like the Nerdlux sucking all the talent out of Patrick Ewing and Charles Barkley via enchanted basketball.
Paginoitis. Do not tell Cam Buckley I said that. I don't know what it is either.
Cadillac Formula One team simulator driver Simon Pagenaud. I'm so happy he's got that gig.
You know who else has been impressing me?
Some of the rookies, and I know it didn't always translate during the race, but Dennis Hauger putting it on the second row at St. Pete was mighty impressive on debut. And then Mick Schumacher stepped it up by qualifying fourth at Phoenix. Mick Schumacher, who had never driven on an oval before, in anger up until that weekend, he tested on him, of course. He did not bad, but you think, right, that's just testing. What are you going to see in a race? What are you saying? He puts the car fourth. It's Rahal Letterman Lanigan Racing. It's the old 30 car, which not too long ago was a broken chassis that was lapping around Milwaukee slower than Indy Net's cars. And it says to me, one, Mick Schumacher, despite his father's hesitations about running ovals, if he was ever faced with the choice, Mick Schumacher might have some natural talent at this. And two, RLL might have fits this oval package. Might have. And you want to know why I think that? Because Graham Rahal got a ninth place finish at Phoenix.
I was going to say, like, if anything, it's weird to call Louis Foster the disappointing one across the Phoenix weekend when it came to oval prowess. But there's hope. There's genuine hope out of the RLL camp for the first time in a while, because they have been the malaise of oval racing for the last 3 years prior. I think the only oval team that was worse than them in that period was Dale Coyne, with Nolan Siegel getting bumped and then Jacob Abel getting bumped last year. And just generally on ovals, Dale Coyne was like a mile an hour off even the bottom end of the teams out there. RNL was right there with them. They were in the wars when it came to getting bumped. We all know the Graham Rahal famous bumping and then being salvaged by Stefan Wilson's unfortunate injury and what have you. But Catherine Legg, for example, making the field at the 500 in 30th was like considered a really damn good result, which kind of says a lot about where RLL was as an oval team at the time.
Say nothing about Takuma Sato putting an RLL car in the front row last year.
Yeah, and the fact
I don't care if they are giving him the good engines. Do you know how incredible that is?
He's earned it. Takuma Sato is the best oval driver in their camp. Even now at age 49.
Even if we don't know if he's coming back, which I'm confident enough that he is, that I put my flag to the mast and say he's going to be the best 500 only driver this year.
I look forward to Jason reading out the box on the prediction league when it's like Takuma was NA. In case he isn't there, but I do agree. I think he probably will be because they RLL's ran four cars for some time now. Yeah. I've seen no indication to suggest that Takuma won't do it. Man. So I think they'll free up the 75 for him again.
Man, Mick Schumacher is so unlucky to be bottom of the points table right now because the shit that happened in St. Pete, and then he had a slow pit stop and he was buried down in 18th of Phoenix.
Yeah, no fault of his own really either. It was a bad pit stop during the race itself, a mishap from the RLL pit crew, screwed Mick over, lost a lap and never really got it back, unfortunately. Just unfortunate because, again, that qualifying effort, he was one of the early dudes to run out and qualify, and then he just nailed his run. And it was only until about half an hour that it'd be realized, wait, this was actually really good. And when you start seeing some of the bigger names like Scott Dixon and Santino Ferrucci and Scott McLaughlin end up slower because he made a mistake during his run. And it was only really the Penske's that were definitively quicker, over the course of the weekend. It was wild. So promising signs for RLL and promising signs for Mick Schumacher that he might actually be able to wheel this thing. We'll have to wait and see.
Promising signs, too, for Dennis Hauger and Roden Streetcourse has turned that third place start into a 10th place finish at St. Pete. And the thing is, it's not even a dead cert that he's going to run Marcus Ericsson out of his job because fair play to Marcus, he was matching him at St. Pete. This is what you've been expecting the last couple of years.
If I need you to get me a top 10, I'll get you seventh. If you need me to finish on the podium, I'll get you seventh.
And if you need Dennis Hauger to spin and crash, he's going to avoid the wall like he's playing driver on the PS1.
You stole my gag, you fucker. No, but that's it. If anyone's ever played Driver on the original PlayStation and the tutorial to start the game, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about with that car park run and having to nail everything on that notepad list. The handbrake 180 was essentially what Dennis Hauger pulled off because he loses control of the car through turn two in Phoenix. He spun out, but when he's going backwards, he turns the gearbox around, puts it in reverse, and is able to straighten the car out and drive away. A remarkable bit of car control from Dennis Hauger on that one. And look, wasn't to be on the oval, but on his first road course, as I also say, first street course running St. Pete, made the Fast Six on merit, as did Romain Grosjean, double Dale Coyne top 10. The first time they've had two cars in the top 10 since 2022 in Gateway, when it was Malukas spearheading that team in his first real big day in an IndyCar. Fantastic turnout from. Like, I'm glad that Dale Coyne is showing some potential and that Dennis Hauger is he was a top tier level F3 prospect when he won the title over there. It never quite worked out for him in F2, but the speed was there. He was not slow. He was a sprint race winner in Formula 2. That is worth something, and he's one of the most talented dudes that have made that leap over. And if Christian Lundgaard can now establish himself as a top 5 level driver in the series on a good day, there's no reason why Dennis Hauger can't also be in that conversation one day.
Yeah, Dennis Hauger set a blueprint that we were kind of projecting would happen to Alex Dunn, except it wasn't really rooted in reality. It was just kind of more wishful thinking.
How many strays do you want to throw out over Alex Dunn over this recorded session?
This one, I'm not bagging on his driving this time. It's just like, it's just very funny.
You're right about the
Dennis Hauger is, Dennis Hauger set a blueprint of like, you don't have to go straight into IndyCar out of Formula 2. You can just go to Indy Nets and level up there. Although if a driver like Sebastian Montoya wanted to go to IndyCar, he can just go straight to IndyCar. They know who his dad is.
Yeah. Like, it's like, Montoya, you say? Robert Hand's like Birdman.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Dre, you know, I joked on previous podcasts that, man, with the latest going on with Roger Penske and his optics, I didn't think it'd be so bad if Joseph Newgarden got let go by Penske if things didn't turn out that great. But
wins round two.
You know what? No matter what happens, he has leverage going into 2027. And that's better than what some of y'all were saying was going to happen.
I will call my shot right now. Joseph Newgarden in the number 6 McLaren next year. I'm that confident. I still think he walks away from Penske at the end of the year. And I think he ends up in a McLaren to round off the dream team that Zak Brown clearly wants to put on over there. He wants three quality drivers. Somehow didn't go after Will Power last year because they wanted Nolan Siegel's cash. We all know where the weakness is in that McLaren lineup. Could you imagine a McLaren team of Joseph Newgarden, Palo Award, and Christian Lundgaard? Dear God.
I mean, that would be like a murder's row lineup. But you know what's encouraging to me is like, qualifying at St. Pete kind of went like a lot of Joseph Newgarden's last couple of years on road and street courses. Yeah. Spoiler alert, it was terrible. He qualified 23rd. But he got back up to 7th. Some of that was strategy. Some of that was just good driving. He follows that up with a win at Phoenix. Like, do we need to see more at Long Beach, Barber, and Arlington? Sure. But
I think so.
I think whatever has been ailing him the last couple of years, it seems like it's not with him to start 2026.
Maybe he's finally got a bit of stability again after all the years. And get me wrong, we've talked about Joseph a lot on this show for the last 2-3 years because his career has declined. There's absolutely no avoiding that going through the end of last season. It was
Scott McLaughlin's the guy. When Tim Cindric came back to Penske, he went to Scott. He didn't go back to Joseph. He went to Scott.
Yeah, like they are now treating McLaughlin like the number one driver in the team, and he's earned it. In all fairness to McLaughlin, he's earned that right. And you know, Newgarden was 12th in points last year. That is not something we expect of a driver that has won everything you can win in this series and has more wins than Rick Mears. Like Joseph is this generation's arguable best IndyCar driver alongside Alex. It's between those two, in my opinion, because a lot of Dixon's success has come a little bit outside of this modern era since we've covered it on the show. You can debate that one amongst yourselves, but it's been a very promising start. Yeah, again, the qualifying in St. Pete was messy, but he got his head down, kept it quiet, and ended up taking good points by finishing 7th in St. Pete. And the end of this race was a classic Newgarden oval comeback. What's Joseph really, really good at on an IndyCar oval? 1, raw speed. 2, moving through traffic and being courteous in passing other cars. And that's exactly what Joseph did. He was patient. He took his time. He picked them off bit by bit, left himself more than enough time to get around Kyle Kirkwood and take what ended up being a relatively comfortable win in the end.
Experience matters at this discipline of racing.
Once he got around Pato, you knew. Once he got around, because Pato was in front of him and he was on the same strategy at the end. So I thought, okay, Pato might be the problem here. But once he got around Pato, there was no stopping him. And it was another classic Newgarden oval win. Yes, strategy helped, of course, getting a late caution with 30 to go or 35 to go roughly helps, but that's how IndyCar oval races run typically. That's how it goes. You get that late caution and then you split the field. The back markers are all going to pit the tires because why not when you're running 10th? And you know, the guys at the front will think, can we hold on and keep track position? It's classic IndyCar oval racing. And Newgarden was in the right place at the right time. And that's what you've got to be in an IndyCar oval race.
So now he leads the points. You're calling your shot. I have kind of like a 50-50 chance that maybe he could lead Penske. Talk about guys that left Penske. I don't want Will Power to go out sad with Andretti Global.
No, I like
Will. I think a lot of people were very excited about the prospect of Will Power. No longer with Penske, getting to show what he could do with another team. And they were saying the Will Power revenge tour is on. Right? He's finally been unshackled. And they were couching a lot of that too. Some of them were, not everybody were couching that a lot of like, David Malukas is nowhere near the driver that Will Power is, and he never will be. I'm like, okay, but David Malukas has talent. He showed that when he put the car up a pole at Phoenix, right?
Crushed the field in qualifying. It was three quarters of a mile an hour up on the field.
So unfortunate that it didn't turn into his first victory, but that first win is coming.
Absolutely.
Will Power, no doubt, joining Andretti Autosport. It has gone even worse than I had feared, because he hit the wall at St. Pete and he hit the wall at Phoenix. And I know the Phoenix one was more 50-50 with racing with Rasmussen and all that. But Will Power is like a demigod on street circuits, and you don't expect him to miss the first cut in qualifying and then just crash out the race on his own.
It's concerning. I mean, again, I'm not sure how concerned we should be, because it is only two weekends. Yeah. It is a small sample size. And I said that
Will was fast at Phoenix.
And Will was quick in Phoenix. There's no doubt about that. He was, again, there is concerns. I mean, in St. Pete, he crashed at turn 10 multiple times that weekend, including the race. I had to park the car early in that one, which was not ideal. It's not typical Will Power, because even if you ignore the crashes, he wasn't particularly quick in St. Petersburg either. He qualified midfield, and again in the race made an uncharacteristic mistake, and then Phoenix he crashes again. You know, and I think he's probably a little bit more responsible for that crash with Rasmussen in Phoenix.
Yeah,
I mean, you compare the two big flashpoints was Palou and VK. Palou, well, I think VK was a lot more of a racing incident, where VK shooting a gap where I think Palou wasn't expecting him to be. Palou admitted his spotter didn't tell him that VK was going to make it an unclear situation soon. Checks up into him by accident. Palou gets turned into the wall, race over.
It's 50-50, really.
Yeah, I think that's a racing incident. Are you telling me Power had no idea where Rasmussen was on that run? Because that was a lot more side-by-side running, and Rasmussen had been running the high line all day. Like, that was... Are you telling me you had no idea where he was? Because that's what Christian thinks, because they had words outside the garage after the race was over, and I think it was, to be kind, an agree-to-disagree type situation.
Yeah,
because Rasmussen was pissed, because, like, the words to TV afterwards was, you can't just put a dude in the wall. And while I don't think it's quite as simple as that, I think Will's racecraft was a bit ropey on that one.
I think it's crazy that we're now just like coming up with the idea that maybe Andretti running the number 26 is cursed. Because Colton Herta, what defined Colton Herta's time at Andretti the last couple of years, right? Blazing speed and fits of awful, 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 terrible, no good, very bad luck.
Yeah, a lot of bad luck, bad pit crew, errors there, and again, like, incredibly quick, but prone to errors. Some more costly than others, like his last, like, remember, he was an IndyCar Series runner-up in 2024, and it was a season where he spun out from second in the Indy 500, got too aggressive trying to pass Tristan Vautier, of all people, in Detroit, and the first race in Milwaukee had his wheel fall off. If two of those three land, he wins the championship.
Yeah.
And we're having a very different conversation about Colton Herta. So I'm not necessarily sure the 26 is cursed, because I think Colton has to hold his hands up to a fair share of accountability for his time in that team. But look, it's only a couple of rounds. I don't want to put the alarm bells out just yet, but it's not just the... what's gone well with Wilson's joining Andretti so far?
A lot of brand new fans, because the thing, like, Will Power, when he was with Penske, was always kind of a somewhat divisive figure, especially in his prime. People thought that his worst, he was a pissed off malcontent who always bitched and moaned whenever he got his, whenever he didn't get away. Now that he's left Penske, and look, he did get a raw deal getting pushed out of Penske because they didn't think to offer him a contract extension when he would have gone and signed it. And the reason why they didn't go inside it, because the team is up in upheaval because of all the cheating scandals.
Mm-hmm. He left because Penske was a messy bitch, and he felt like he was being disrespected after 17 years with that team. He felt like, you know...
Understandably, that resonates with people, especially when you were driving for the evil empire of American open wheel racing, right?
Right.
You want to see that guy do well.
Yeah, like, I personally have always liked Will. Yes, he has some moments of rage. He can be a bit stuck up sometimes. I still remember one of him threatening to punch Romain Grosjean in the face, which was not cool, but we also didn't know until later on that year that his wife nearly died from a staph infection. It's understandable that he might be a bit pissed off. You know, Will's always kind of split people down the middle. I like Will. I've always liked Will. I think he's a fun guy to have. I think he's a fun character and a fun personality. I would like to see him do well at Andretti. Definitely. No doubt in my mind about that. But it's been a disaster so far. There's no getting around it. It couldn't have gone much worse if he tried, quite frankly. And look, brand new race in Arlington coming up. You know, maybe that'll be the blank canvas that he needs to just go attack it and see what happens. But something needs to change quite quickly.
He's only ahead of the following people in the standings. Mick Schumacher, who, as I mentioned, was crashed out four corners into his first race. Stingray Rob, who has never looked impressive. And 12,000 shares of Nortel Siegel. That's it.
Sell. This is what could possibly go wrong.
Again, he's not an outright bad driver, but it's clear that this IndyCar thing isn't working. And if you need Linus Lundqvist at a short pinch, he's been sitting around the garage for the last year and change or so, man. I don't know what to tell you, man. I don't know what to tell you. That combination just isn't working.
He's trying his career. He read Connor Benn's news and decided to try and take up boxing, because that's where the money is, apparently. Who knew?
All right. What else is... Dre, do you have anything else that has impressed you, disappointed you, etc. this year? I mean, the production of the broadcast is always a perpetual disappointment, but did we really have expectations for that?
I don't know what's happened between Fox coming in and the IMS production truck, because once again, you weren't here for it, RJ, but we didn't really get a fully working timing tower until about two-thirds distance.
Not the first timing tower discourse of the weekend, because did you hear that they took the decimal places out of Formula One?
People will get mad about anything. Like, geez, oh my God, we can't follow a gap as much with three decimal.
Look, this one is a bit more justifiable because it's Phoenix, it's a short oval, and not everybody has just like... They didn't come up in short oval brain where they could just track all these cars making a 20-second lap, like, automatically like that.
No. And look, the F1 argument notwithstanding, like, IndyCar, it's unacceptable. It's just unacceptable that Fox has been in tandem with these dudes now for over a calendar year, and the IMS production truck cannot put together a working timing tower 2 hours into a race. That's unacceptable. You're meant to be a world-class production facility, and you can't give us a working timing tower.
You are the broadcast company that gave us the score bug on the upper left-hand corner of the screen during the National Football League season in 1994, and it changed television broadcasting of American sports forever. Where is that, Fox Sports? I know you're busy trying to like figure out how to fix all the thinness in the front end of the schedule. I know you're trying to figure out how to get the season out past football season in a way that like doesn't completely embarrass yourselves in the television ratings, because I know they want it to end the season, and I think it'll be good, great for the calendar density. But are you really going to get that big of a ratings bump?
Which is amazing, because again, they've had a good start to the year TV rating wise. They did 1.4 in St. Pete again, same as last year, and they did 1.2. Like they did 1.25 this past weekend in Phoenix, which was way better than the 700,000 that tuned into Thermal this time last year.
Everything was better than Thermal, to be fair.
True, it's a low bar, but it's still a test still
track
a good
that should have never been a racetrack.
Yeah, and it's going to be very intriguing to see how Arlington does, because this was a very much big hyped Grand Prix, and they've thrown a lot of marketing money at this Texas race this weekend, even if it was somewhat curtailed by something which we'll get to at the end of the show. But it's like the TV ratings are going well. Like people are tuning in. They are generally better than what they were in the previous era. But I still think they're leaving a lot on the table that they could be doing better. And a lot of it is the basics. If you can't get the basics right, then you don't deserve to have 2 million people watching your races. Because like I said, like I still love the fact that Pato O'Ward wasn't really keen about doing a NASCAR IndyCar double until he saw what NASCAR's TV ratings were pulling. I was like, actually, I think this is a great weekend to be around for IndyCar. Stupid boy. You know, like, he has his moments. But, you know, perpetual in IMS production truck moments aside, Christian Lundgaard is still really, really good. A shame he didn't reach up on the oval this weekend. But again, 7th podium finish in St. Pete and 18 starts at McLaren at the time.
Perfect. Like still, he's still moving. Fourth at St. Pete, second in Phoenix. I mean, we just need more of that at the back half of the season. And I'll tell you what, Kirkwood's got Arlington coming up. He's got Long Beach. He's got two really good opportunities to get a win on the board before the Indianapolis 500.
Agreed. Agreed. Definitely. Before we get out of here, I mentioned a minute ago that something might have curtailed the anticipation for the Grand Prix of Arlington, because as mentioned, there was a lot of crossover. We had Joey Logano in the IndyCar box for a little while. We had Hinchcliffe and Bell in for the NASCAR race.
Yeah, Hinchcliffe and Bell showing up on the NASCAR commentary duties and immediately doing a better job than the people who are employed full time to do this at times.
I don't think I've said this on the podcast. Kevin Harvick is really, really damn good as a broadcaster. Yeah.
Kevin Harvick is an amazing broadcaster. He's just trying too hard to be relatable to his children. Clint Boyer tries way too hard to be Daryl Waltrip and pulls none of that off. Mike Joy is 80. He's slowing down a bit. He's still really good, but not as good as he once was. You gotta understand, he's 80 years old.
You forget he's 80.
Yeah.
Like, you would never guess he was 80 by listening to him, but man, like, you know, yeah, he's slowing down as you would expect of someone of his age. You know, like it's understandable.
76, rounded up to 80, it's close enough, man. He's not Al Michaels, but he's in the game a long time. Anyway, like we had a lot of crossover promotional material, Phoenix, and we got Arlington coming up. You remember that vanity project for the current United States administration that's sending us into another long and stupid war out in the Middle East?
Fun times.
Well, they didn't. Okay, so they had a few days to decide the course layout, and we didn't hear about it. So we were wondering, had they decided a layout? Well, they did. We got it. We got the layout for the Freedom 250 Grand Prix. And they made sure to hit all the big highlights. We got Pennsylvania Avenue. We got the Capitol Building. We got the National Mall. All that looks great on 3D renders, because if you look at it from a top-down perspective, this looks this looks rough.
It looks shit. RJ. It is a Roval. Call it what it is.
It looks like a fucking fist with a thumb jutting out of it. And I find it ironic that there are so many left turns here.
Yes, that's very unlike this current administration, isn't it? Right. Yeah. It's a 1.66 mile street circuit.
Yeah.
The longest straight is going to be down Pennsylvania Avenue, and it's 0.4 of a mile long. For those who need some context, that's roughly the same length as St. Pete's Main Straight, and St. Pete's Main Straight is not a passing opportunity under normal circumstances around that track. Beyond that, it's a fling of 90 degree corners, basically turn three, turn four, turn five. And basically, 7 and 1 are all 90-degree corners. Classic street circuits.
They're going to get the Lincoln Memorial, our nation's most phallus national monument, in the shot.
It's hard not to be disappointed. Like, and I wasn't sure what I was expecting here, really. But what we got was somehow worse. It is laughably bad. And I think it's going to be like a 50-second hot lap with no passing opportunities. Because where are you going to pass around here?
Well, you could always try and force it up the inside and cause like a multi-car pileup, which is probably one of the more likely options.
Well, we got that a lot when we raced in Nashville Street Track. How many times did we get someone lunge down the inside and end up putting it in the wall? Like, we got
guys,
that
we're racing over the freaking National Mall. How cool is this? Don't worry, because all the promotion is going to be handled by Monumental Sports and Entertainment, the company that also owned the Washington Wizards, which conceded 83 points to a good but not great or elite basketball player for all the world to see recently.
I wonder how Jerry Jones and Miller, the boss of the Grand Prix of Arlington, feel that their big headline race, which they've planned for the last 2.5 years, has been upstaged by Joseph Newgarden in a suit at the Capitol building unveiling the new layout of this track, which looks like it's going to be a one-shot in August, 5 months away. Could this not have waited until next week?
Hey, Dre, don't forget, all the profits from this race are going to nonprofit organizations, going to charities. I mean, it's going to rake in so much money.
Where? Where? money who? Money where? The sponsors of the teams might do quite well if Graham Rahal was telling the truth when this was unveiled like last month.
You can leverage all the corporate partners of all the great Washington, D.C. teams, like the Wizards, who gave up 83 points to Bam Adebayo recently.
And 150 points to the Heat in general in a game of basketball. Good Lord. No, I mean, look. We know what our feelings are on this. We talked about it when it was first announced. This is a crock of bullshit. And the layout is only reinforcing my beliefs that this is a crock of bullshit. Can I get one quick vent in here as well, real quick, before we get out of here? Because the news dropped today that Connor Daly is coming back for the 500. Good for him. He's racing for Drea Reinebold Racing alongside Jack Harvey.
That'll be a fast car.
It's a fast car. It's sponsored by Kingspan.
Okay, now we're going to need to like unpack the context here, because Kingspan was one of the insulation supply companies that was insulating Grenfell Towers when it went up in flames and killed 72 people. Kingspan has long deflected responsibility, saying, well, we didn't install it on this building. It's not our problem.
Now, I need to point out, it's not just Kingspan that are ultimately responsible.
Yeah.
The decisions were made when building that tower block. They decided, in their infinite wisdom, to not have fireproof cladding. But, look, I get it. If there's one thing I will always respect Connor Daly for, it's that he's always loved IndyCar like an adopted son and has done everything in his power to stay in the series, in and out, thick and thin through the last decade and a half. I will always applaud him for that. He truly loves IndyCar and he truly loves to race in it. That is valuable. But when it's getting to the point where you're taking funny money and now taking money from the cladding company responsible for Grenville Tower, how desperate have you got to be to stay on the IndyCar grid in some capacity?
And remember, this is not Kingspan's first major motorsport sponsorship. You don't remember that they sponsored Mercedes-AMG Formula One team, though, because as soon as Lewis Hamilton heard about this and spoke up about the partnership, they broke that off like a stick of linguine.
Not quite, though, because this was Saudi Arabia 2021. They announced they were putting Kingspan on Lewis Hamilton's car. Hamilton basically had to give it the diplomatic reason of, don't talk to me, I don't make these decisions, because he was understandably asked by the press, well, how do you feel about that? Because Hamilton had spoken out publicly defending the victims of Grenville and talking about how they wanted to find justice for many of their family members who had died and passed away in that horrible disaster. Toto Wolff at the time had the gall of writing an open letter trying to justify that sponsorship deal.
We were just talking about this incident too, offline, and then this comes up.
And it took an open letter back and forth of the Grenville Survivors Union before Toto backed out of the deal, because it was a horrible fucking look. And it's the exact reason why, me personally, I think Toto Wolff and Christian Horner are two sides of the same asshole, quite frankly, at times, because while one abused his power, the other abused his money. And Toto Wolff should really know better, quite frankly.
Harrison sitting here with Apollo's gift of prophecy.
I hate that I've got this dodgeball in my hand. And the thing is, I want to like Connor. I think he's a decent person deep down.
Yeah.
But if you're this desperate to stay in IndyCar, you've got to understand people are going to rightly shit on you from a great height for this, because that is a horrible sponsor to take and it makes you look like an asshole.
Yeah. And also, why did Dreyer and Reinbold Racing sign off on this when it seems like there's plenty of American sponsors of various levels of repute that could have signed on to this project?
They're a very good 500 specialist team that has been hovering around top 10s for multiple years now. They didn't need to do this. And if they didn't need to do this, then they're bad at sponsor acquisition, because it takes 5 minutes of Googling Kingspan for any reasonable person to think, you know what? Maybe it's not worth it.
Airbus was willing to sponsor an IndyCar show car right now. You think they wouldn't love to sponsor IndyCar's foremost Irish American driver?
As Kira, the fantastic patron support we have in our chat, has quite rightly said, and they Connor turned Connor down. Yeah.
That's crazy, dog.
Quote,
they'll turn Connor down, Harold Lingus will turn Connor Daly down, but not Depends and not Kingspan.
Amazing. What a fucked up series we enjoy. Let's get out of here. Grand Prix of Arlington this weekend. Oh, by the way, small note. One shot qualifying this weekend in the fast six round. Interesting. Apparently it's going to be a trial for potentially a permanent change on road and street tracks. I'm kind of for it, because I think having a 6 minute fast six has always been a bad TV product. Yeah. You want people to care about your drivers, you need more than 6 minutes to showcase their abilities, in my opinion. So I'm kind of for it, even if one shot bores me, generally speaking, but we'll see how that goes in Arlington. That Grand Prix this weekend, we'll review it next week on Motorsport 101 as per usual. As mentioned before, we've got Formula One in China, Sprint Weekend this weekend on top of that as well. Got another week to look for MotoGP returns for a brand new race in Brazil. Anyway, that'll do it on this week's episodes. I've been Dre Harrison. He's been RJ O'Connell. Thank you very much for watching and listening. And until next time, thank you very much for listening. Sign out.
Later, y'all.
So how fast do you think Dennis Hauger did that driver tutorial?
If he passed it on the first try, I know some people are going to be throwing their PlayStation controllers through the television.
Me being one of them.